You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
I want to be a producer with a hit show on Broadway. I want to be a producer.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Producer's Perspective podcast. I'm Ken Davenport. Today's guest has done a lot of things in this business, which is a theme for a lot of our guests, actually. But this guy has been an actor on Broadway in shows like A Few Good Men, which I'm still angling to bring back. He's directed. He's a producer as well, having just produced the last 5 years movie. But he's most well known for being the founder of one of the leading cast album companies on Broadway, Shikaboom Records. Welcome Grammy Award winner Kurt Deutsch.
Hello.
So let me tell you a little bit about the story of how I met Kurt. It was 2005, I think, and I got an email saying, "Hey, Ken, I hear you're doing this show called Altar Boys. I want to talk to you about it." So we met at the Café Luxembourg, which is right across the street from my house. We had a burger, and he said what my favorite words, which are, "Hey, Ken, we're doing something completely different over at Shikaboom." And he had a great idea and a new model for doing cast albums. And we did Altar Boys, of course. And the album is great. Go pick it up on Shikaboom. And then since then, Kurt has gone on through Shikaboom and Ghostlight Records, his other label. They've done everything from Book of Mormon, Newsies, In the Heights, Next to Normal, Elf, my production of Godspell, and many, many more, including a ton of solo albums for Broadway artists, including Sutton Foster, Alice Ripley, Adam Pascal. It's a lot of albums, Kurt. How many albums have you done, do you think, now?
I think in our catalog, there's over 150 albums.
150?
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
So tell me what the impetus was for starting Shikaboom, how it all started for a guy who was an actor and a producer.
Well, originally we started it in, I guess, 1999, 2000, and Sherry Renee Scott, who co-founded the label with me, and Adam Pascal were doing Aida. And there was, I think, cast albums were not even part of the picture initially. It was really about, after Rent, there's this new generation of Broadway fan because of the internet, and a new generation of Broadway artist who didn't necessarily want to grow up and just do show tune records. So we had this idea to start a label for artists who are bridging the gap between rock and roll and theater. And so that's how Shikaboom really started. It started as a kind of a united artist for Broadway actors to do their own thing. So Adam Pascal wrote his own music, Alice Ripley wrote her own music, and Sherry had this idea for an album called Men I've Had, featuring songs by the composers she worked with, who happened to be like Elton John and Pete Townsend, and so covers of those albums. And so that's really how it all started. And we felt like, because they were doing 8 shows a week on Broadway, we would be able to have a built-in audience for these artists. And so we put their websites in their bios and basically said, you know, "I have a solo album, go to SherryReneeScott.com and, you know, and buy it." And Disney was able to, you know, sell the solo records in the theater. And it was, so basically that's the genesis of how it all started. And then we started doing cast albums a few years later, as I learned more about the music industry.
What was the first cast album you did?
The first cast album we did was The Last 5 Years, the off-Broadway production of The Last 5 Years. And basically the idea, you know, I read this book called Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About the Music Business or something. It's one of those kind of like, you know, how to succeed in business. So it's like Everything You Want to Know About. It was by a guy named Donald Passman, I think was his name. Anyway, How to Start Your Own Record Label. And we were in my second bedroom and just working. But basically what I found out was the recording contracts were so unfair to the artists. You know, really, artists make their money not necessarily from the sale of their records. They make their money from touring or from the publishing of the songs. And so the royalty is very, very, very small. And historically, Broadway cast albums, major labels would do them, and the producer or the show wouldn't necessarily make a lot of money off of the cast album. And I couldn't believe that a producer would give one of their most major assets away. And so we created a profit-sharing structure and an ability for producers to co-own or own the master recordings and share in the profits much, much earlier. And so that's really how it all started. So with The Last 5 Years, Ariel Tepper and Marty Bell were the producers, and I basically went to them and said, hey, I love this show. I think it's a masterpiece. Why don't we just put the money up, pay for it, and hopefully we'll make some money off of this record. And so that was really the first cast album we did that way. And that was when we kind of invented the model. And since then, and that album has made a lot of money. We made a movie of it, and because of the album, it's had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of productions around the world, and it's been great.
So before that, you were literally in your bedroom reading. You don't have a music recording background. You didn't go to school for any of this stuff.
No. I was an actor, and pretty much all my life. And then I went to college for directing, and I always did musicals in the summer. I knew musical theater. I cared deeply about musical theater. I wanted to produce. I wanted to direct. I wanted to do all of those things. And acting was just how I made money, doing television. But then when Sherry and I married, we met doing Randy Newman's musical Faust. I was living in Los Angeles at the time, and then we moved back to New York, and I did my Sex and the City, and I did my Law and Order, and I did my, you know, the things that at that time, the things that filmed here, and I was like, I wanted more. And so we had this idea to start this company, and that's kind of how it all happened.
Was it hard to convince Marty and Ariel to take a stab at this?
You know, the album was not the most expensive record to make, so it wasn't hard, actually, because it was very natural. I think what's hard is that when a lot of producers are so used to the old way, but when I showed them what, you know, if we sold this amount of units, like what you could make, or, you know, and the thing is that when you look, you know, it's not like a hit record. You know, that's going to kind of just like sell a lot of units and then not ever sell. It's like The Last 5 Years sells every week 100 records. And it's been that way. And it's been that way for, you know, since 2002, just every week, it'll just continually say, it's just because people are discovering these things. You know, there's a revival, or Jason has a new musical, or Sherry or Norbert are in show. It constantly regenerates because there's always musical theater students who are just wanting to discover or find. Now that the movie is out, you know, it's having a whole new rebirth, you know, and so cast albums I look at as kind of annuities. You know, they're not flash in the pans. They're things that just are going have a very, very long shelf life and a long tail is basically the way that I look at it.
that was one of the things I was most excited about doing with the Godspell album, because I knew there would probably not be another major Godspell production. There had only been the original for in terms of a first-class recording. And that show, which is done all over the place and all the time, mm-hmm. will live on for decades yep. and decades.
Yeah.
How much did that last 5 years album cost to make back then?
I think that that album cost around $90,000, something like that.
And for me, I remember when you made the pitch to me, one of the comparisons I thought of was that the big studio, quote-unquote, cast albums seemed to never make money in a way that people describe it, like Hollywood. There were all this bullshit, you know, different accounting lines, and it seemed that they never made money, which, of course, the Cats recording made money.
Yeah, yeah. The way that the royalty structure, you know, works kind of in the old traditional way is very, very weighted for the record label. The artist, and in the case of cast albums, the artist is the Broadway show, has a very small royalty. So basically what ends up happening is I remember drawing diagrams to you and like explaining to you like in a pie, you know, the simplest way I can say is that let's just say that you get $10 in the door, and it costs $100,000 to make a record and you have a 10% royalty. $1 goes to the artist in a little piggy bank and $9 goes to the record label essentially. And when that $1 reaches $100,000, that's when the royalty for the show would kick in. Meanwhile, the label will have made $900,000. That's the simplest way that I can describe it, but it seemed very, very unfair to me. So basically what I said was, why don't we just all do it together? You know, and when it pays its money back, then we all share in it. I mean, that just seems fair, you know? It just seems more fair.
And, you know, we often talk about the recoupment rate of Broadway shows being 1 out of 5. On average, what do you think the recoupment rate is for albums these days?
Music has changed so drastically over the past. I mean, when I first started making these records, we were still doing it on tape. You know, it's like now it's all digital. Amazon and iTunes. Amazon was just starting. iTunes was not existent. And streaming, of course, was completely out of the picture. There's no YouTube or anything like that. So things have changed drastically over the last, you know, even 2 years. But, you know, a show that has a limited run, that is being preserved for not necessarily to make money, doesn't make its money back. A show, you know, because if let's just say it was a show like, Giant, for example, which was Michael John Lacusa's, beautiful musical at the Public Theater. It's to me just like his score is a masterpiece. And, you know, and it was paid for by, you know, a foundation. The album was paid for by a foundation in the Public Theater, Ted Shen Family Foundation. And he's there to support Michael John and the public, and never thought that it would make its money back. You know, so it's, you know, without a cast album, it's as if the musical doesn't exist, you know. So that's there for licensing purposes. It's there for a lot of other things. But a show like Book of Mormon or, you know, name a hit Broadway musical that runs for years and years and has multiple companies and that just continues to run, those will make its money back. So I think of things very differently in terms of, okay, what is the purpose? And I'm pretty honest with the producers and I say, you know, I don't think that this is going to make its money back, but I know how important it is for you to have a record for marketing purposes, for future licensing, for all of those things. So you need to record it and we'll figure out the most economical way that you can record it. But for a show that I think will make money, I'll say, you know, we should do this. And I think that this is a really good investment and you're going to make money on this thing. So.
And it seems like the recording of albums has become a lot easier in the past 10, 20 years, just the physical recording of it.
It has and it hasn't. I mean, it's easy to, you know, now you can mix a record anywhere. But you still need, especially for cast albums, you need the recording studio to be able to actually, you need a big recording studio to bring a giant cast of, you know, however big a cast is and band and everything like that. And unfortunately, the recording studios in New York are dwindling. You know, we used to have some amazing recording studios, the Hit Factory, and you know, lots of great places, but space is hard to come by now. And so yeah, we have to just kind of really figure out how we're going to record it in the best way. So that's it's easier to record, but it's harder to figure out where to record now.
When do you think a producer should start thinking about doing an album? Like, where in the process? It seems to me that every musical has an album when it gets to a certain place, off-Broadway or Broadway. When should a producer start planning that?
Well, there's a twofold answer. I think that when you're raising money for the show, you should put the cast album in your capitalization budget no matter what. You should put the budget for the cast album in your capitalization budget, and you should actually negotiate the mechanical rights. You should negotiate all of the stuff with the authors from the get-go. And secondly, you should record the album when the show is frozen, when the show is not going to have any more changes, when it's done and you're ready to launch. I think that it makes sense to maybe lay down a few tracks as kind of demo recordings or for marketing purposes, maybe one or two or three songs, you know, prior to kind of as your marketing campaign goes. But for the most part, I wouldn't release an original cast album. A revival is different. An original cast album until the show is actually complete, and that's what you want to put out into the world.
So let's just go back to this building it into the budget, because this is a trend that I've been seeing some producers do. Some people like to keep it separate, raise money for it separately. But by putting it into that original budget, then the show owns that album. So all the investors of that in that show are getting the benefit of that album for years and years, whether or not the show is a hit.
Yeah.
So that's what you recommend?
I would recommend doing it that way because you don't have to worry about it. I even tell not-for-profit theaters, you know, if you're going to produce a new musical, you know, whether it's at the Public or Playwrights Horizons or the Roundabout or wherever it is, it's like, I know money is hard to come by, you know, and you're putting all of the money into the production and everything, but you know you're going to need the record. And so you're scrambling around trying to find a label to put the money in or trying to find this person to do, but just know that you're going to make the record, know that it's going to happen, and just earmark that and know that it's going to be there, because ultimately, I don't care where you put it in the marketing budget. You need that music to sell a musical, you know, and if you can offset it maybe down the road, then, and somebody wants to come in like me or a guy says, hey, I'd like a piece of the record or whatever it is, then you don't necessarily have to put all of it in, but just know that it's there. It's like a safety net so that you don't have to worry about it.
It's such a smart idea. And look, I traditionally have built them separately. I put my album separate. But now that I think about it, you know, I think our initial reaction to producers is like, oh, don't give me another couple hundred thousand dollars to raise. I don't want to do that. But the fact is, it is such a safety net. Partly because if the show isn't received well in the first couple months, and you're still going to want to do the album.
Right.
And then you're really going to be in trouble in terms of raising that money, because every investor is going to say, well, how long is it going to run on Broadway? Because I'm sure you'll tell us that shows sell the most albums when you're doing 8 shows a week and 2,000 people a night are seeing.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. They do. They sell, you know, you can guarantee that you're going to sell a few hundred records a week. Whether, you know, as long as the show is running on Broadway and it's a hit, you know. So I just think that it makes a lot of sense to just not worry. And it was the same thing that I said, you know, when I initially kind of came up with the model, when I would talk to producers, they said exactly what you're saying. It's like, I don't want to have to worry about raising the money because these albums never make money. And I'm like, yes, they do make money. It's just that you're not seeing it. So And you know, and there's a lot of producers who feel that the traditional way is the right way, and you know, but things have changed now. Distribution is so easy, and you just put it out there, and they. So I mean, the thing that's hard now is really the economics, because of the streaming services and how we're getting paid, whether it's Spotify or Apple Music, and there's just a lot. People don't feel like they should be paying for music anymore. So that's the hard challenge for any label, I think, really, is how are people going to buy, or how are people consuming? You know, CDs are going to be gone. I mean, they don't even put CD players in computers anymore. So it's like those are going to be gone. So it's like, really, how are we going to monetize music in the long term? And I think that the union contracts have to change. I think that a lot of things have to change given what's going on for the future.
And what do you think the future looks like? If you could take a look 10 years, 20 years into the future in terms of music.
I think it's going to be subscription-based. I mean, artists are not going to stop creating, and so music is always going to exist. But I think that we're going to have to adapt with the cost of how things are being made. And I think that what's going to end up happening is like with Apple, if it's Apple or whatever, it's all going to be subscription-based. So you're going to see millions of millions of millions of people subscribing to Apple Music, right? That's why Spotify doesn't really exist, because it's ad-generated right now. There's not enough subscribers to really pay. But once there's one company, whether it's Apple or whoever it is, and there's 80 million people or 100 million people subscribing to that service, then you're going to see, I think, a more equitable distribution of the money. It may not be the same as buying a record, but you're going to see a more equitable distribution, and people are going to be getting, you're going to be getting paid more, or the artist is going to be getting paid more. So I think that's probably what's going to end up happening.
If the CD disappears, what the hell are we going to sell in the theaters? Anything?
Well, I mean, it's interesting, because I've thought that what you're going to end up selling is a poster with a little code that says, you know, here's the record, or a T-shirt that has a little code that, you know, I also feel like, you know, you go to the theater, you should buy a ticket. I mean, what my dream would be is that everybody who buys a ticket gets an email, and the record is given to them. And you take a few dollars off of the ticket price that goes towards paying back the record, and then everybody makes money, because you're, number one, spreading the word of the music for everybody who goes to see the show. They have that to listen to. Hey, I saw this great show, listen to this music. Then they're going to buy a ticket and they're going to get the record. So it's like, I just feel like that's the way to do it. And if you did it that way and you gave $4 or whatever, and they feel like they got it for free, but you gave $4 back to the record or the capitalization, then you will have paid back your record in, you know, 3 months, basically, because all those people will have seen it. So I think that would be a great thing to do if you can do that. You'll probably have to say something to the theater owners and everybody else who gets a piece of that. But you know what? Sometimes if you own the thing, you can do whatever you want to do with it.
It's a very cool idea. Now, look, you've worked with a lot of producers. You're a producer yourself. What are some of the characteristics of your favorite producers working today? Like, what does it take to be a successful producer on Broadway, do you think, today?
Flexibility, imagination, collaboration, obviously brains, because you've got to, you know, be smart and understand how it works. But I think that the people that I've worked with who are forward thinking, who really think about, you know, what the future of the theater is, who their audience is, who they're trying to attract, what's happening in social media and, you know, the digital age. You know, I think you have to be on top of all of that stuff. But then you also have to be able to communicate to the artists and the composers and the creators and your collaborators the message that you're trying to get across in order to build the best show that you possibly can, I think. And that would be my takeaway from it.
You've been observing Broadway, both as a fan, I'm sure, but also both as a professional. What do you think the current state of the music is on Broadway right now? Someone's recorded all these great albums.
Well, it's amazing, because, you know, you look at a show like Hamilton, and you see how Lin has his roots in traditional musical theater so deeply, but he also has his roots in the popular culture, and it's very exciting how he's blended that. And I think that a lot of the young composers that are coming up, whether it's, you know, Joe Iconis or Jason Robert Brown or Tom Kitt, all of these guys are rooted in traditional theater. They love it. But Joe, you hear Ben Folds in his music, or Jason Robert Brown, there's a lot of Joni Mitchell. I mean, it's like, there's the thing that's amazing about these guys, and it's what I said about, you know, when I started the label with even the performers, they are able to create a vocabulary. The best composers, they're able to create a vocabulary using and storytelling using all of the influences of today, whatever it demands, and then they put their own spin on it. Like Janine Tesori, same thing. It's like she has her own style, but you can hear all of her roots in other music, whether it's Sondheim, whether it's pop music. It's amazing how these young composers are just drawing from all of their influences to create this new sound, I think.
What I love about those three guys that you just mentioned, Tom and Joe and Jason, and how they roots in traditional musical theater, but also pop, all three of those guys have their own bands that mm-hmm. they play in, right? Mm-hmm. Which I think is very, very interesting.
Yeah.
What would be your advice to people with a show that they're developing right now, something new they've written, they're trying to get it onto Off-Broadway or Broadway? How do they record something? Do they hire a label? Do they do something simple? What's the best way to...
It's an interesting thing because I was on the board of the Westin Theater up in Vermont, and we created a award for musicals, new musicals. And the award is basically you go up to Westin, you work for a week developing a musical. And what you don't get money, you don't get anything, but what you get is these actors and a piano player rehearsing a 30-minute concert, and then they come down to New York, and I produce a demo for them. And so what they get out of it is a professionally produced demo that they can then submit to Ryan Beck, you know, all of these, the O'Neill, or for grants, or for whatever, but to create a very... spare demo recording where you can give it to some investors who might be interested, but it's not just a composer sitting in his living room with a tape recorder, you know, because that's just never going to sound good. I don't think you need to have a lot of instruments on it. I think having other actors, real actors, sing on it is valuable. And the quality, even if it's just a piano or a guitar or simple, just really simple, so you hear the lyrics, you hear the basic melody, and you hear good performances. I think that's key.
Okay, Kurt, we're up to my last question now, which has been affectionately referred to as my genie question that I ask all my guests. I want you to imagine that the genie from Aladdin knocks on your door and says, Kurt Deutsch, you've done such an amazing job at preserving so many great shows, some that may have disappeared if it wasn't for you. I want to thank you for that by granting you one wish. What is the one thing that drives you so crazy about Broadway, keeps you up at night, makes you so angry? What's the one thing you wish could just disappear or change in the snap of a finger?
Hard one, but I guess when it comes to my business or my core business, which is the preserving of original cast recordings, is that we somehow collectively, the musicians union, the actors union, and the producers of the shows, and we figure out a way to understand that these albums are marketing tools and for the future of the shows and historical documents, and that we don't think of them as giant paychecks. So these records actually don't have to cost $400,000 to make. They cost a lot less to make and are there for history. And if they do make money, then everybody shares in the making of the money. But unfortunately, all of the contracts were signed or negotiated in a time when Broadway was kind of the pop music of the day, and they were selling hundreds and thousands and millions of units. So, and they haven't really adapted to what's going on now. So I just wish that people under, you know, except you think of these actors. The actors want the record, you know, because they want to say, hey, this was me in this show, and this is my cast album that I'm on, and the fans want it, and musicians do too, you know. Hey, I'm proud of my work, and this was my work, you know, and so I think everybody wants that, but unfortunately it's very hard to get unions to understand that times are changing, and this is really all for posterity. So I really wish that we could all just get in the room and figure out how to just make these records a lot more cheaply so that everybody, so we can preserve all these things.
Well, the theater is known as an industry that doesn't change very rapidly, yet at the same time, you're working in an industry, in the music industry, that's changing at the speed of light.
Yeah. 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 And, you know, in pop records and indie records cost, you know, and they cost basically nothing, you know, I mean, like in terms of production, you know, it's because you've got a guy who's creating electronic sounds in his room, and, you know, and it's like they don't necessarily even use real musicians, you know, so it's just, it's a whole different world. And, you know, and I respect Broadway, and I respect theaters, I respect the actors, and I respect everybody and all the musicians, but I just feel like the original cast album is something that needs to be preserved, and we need to figure out a way to make it cost effectively, because without it, you know, without the record, nobody will be able to listen to these things in the long term.
And you're 100% right about that. If they can't listen to it, they won't want to do it. Yeah. On top of that, we'll have less productions. So making sure we keep these cast albums going and produced for every musical that comes out is essential, I think. Kurt, thank you so much for being with us. Cast albums are indeed an endangered species these days. You've dedicated so much time to making sure that so many shows, again, that may not have been preserved, are preserved for current generations and future generations. And we thank you for that. Thanks to all of you for listening. Coming up on next week's episode, we're going out on the road again with one of the leading presenters of Broadway entertainment in the country. Tune in and don't forget to subscribe.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.